Welcome to Tilth Talk Radio. Today we're going to talk slugs. In our spotlight, we'll take a look at a new GPS datum that is coming. Ag History Minute, we'll talk about the history of the silo. Cool Beans, That's Corny, we'll have some current events. And we'll wrap it all up with a Feel Good Friday. With me this week are Bill Schomburg.
Hey, guys.
Todd Schomburg.
Hey to all the Tilthies out there.
And I'm Matt Brueger, all with Tilth Agronomy. They promised us it was going to cool down, and it kind of did, but it kind of didn't.
I'm kind of pumped how hot it is. I know it's messing with certain things out there, so...
This week was nicer than the last 2 weeks.
I mean, yeah. It wasn't so hot.
Right.
But it's finishing corn, which is a plus. The corn silage doesn't seem to be tanking on us in this heat like it was in the other heat where it was kind of burning up.
Right.
Yeah. So that's good.
We burned all up the corn that we could. Now right. We're moving on maybe to the next batch.
Maybe so. And I've heard of guy like potato harvest is very affected by heat. Like
right.
It can be too hot. So I know for a lot of potato harvesters out there, they're having to start at 4 in the morning and go till noon
right.
before it gets too hot and stuff. So it does. It's interesting what this hot of basically late September, early October can do.
Yeah, it's helping with some things and screwing up other things. And
all that late corn we were worried about.
Yeah,
it can only help.
It can only help, but it also is... It's fooling me into not knowing, because if you're like, oh, shoot, this is like, there's a milk line here now. It's maybe half. Will this make dry? Maybe.
And maybe not.
Yeah, it just is tricky in a frost. You know, the October, you never know when you're going to frost in October. It could be kind of any time.
Right.
Once we get to that timing, so it. Yeah, I think it's making it a little tougher to make decisions, but at the same time, there's still hope that it's pushing it along properly and has a better potential of making it.
Yeah, I mean, as long as there's hope. And yes. Even next week, I mean, it's trending down, but it's
not really
70s.
Yeah,
not, you know... Originally, it looked like it was going to drop into like the 60s this week, and then when you looked at the long term, it was like, oh yeah, October is going to get really cold, but it doesn't seem to be going that way. And with that, the hurricane and stuff, that weather probably won't make it quite to us, but it may impact our weather because it looks like it's coming up through like Indiana is how they got it predicted. So that could play some games with our weather a little bit.
So, yeah, interesting what Halloween will be like this year.
Right. Because ice storms like last year.
Right.
Or
will it be
snow?
Yeah. Could be really warm, could be really cold. Because I remember, I think it was 2 years ago, the kids were like sweating in their costumes because it was so warm on Halloween.
Which doesn't happen very often.
No.
Imagine if Halloween was in end of September instead of end of October, like every year would be nice. You could actually...
Be a nice break, too, between that and, like, Thanksgiving. And
right. Oh, I was in Walmart the other day.
Was it Christmas stuff already?
Yeah, they don't wait long.
Oh, my God. I was like, seriously? You took out the summer, like, grilling patio, like...
Was it, like, Christmas lights and Christmas...
Just anything, like, ornaments and everything's...
Yeah, I feel like they don't stock Halloween costumes after October 1st. Like, if you don't buy your Halloween costume in September or go to a specific Halloween store, like the Halloween Spirit or whatever that pops up in vacant storefronts, like, big box stores don't carry stuff for Halloween into October even, it seems.
I was just ready to puke. I was walking in, I'm like, are you serious? Christmas stuff already?
It's a good segue, though, because there was no puking in the Packer game this week. At least I don't think so. Not that I heard.
And not in the ball.
And they won. No,
yes.
Malik Willis had his revenge game against his former team. And I guess so did Braden Naverson, kind of. I think he was with the Titans for a while there. But
he missed the kick, but it didn't count.
Right. That's the important part is he at least missed the one that didn't count.
Didn't exist. One of our colleagues went to the game. I talked to him yesterday. He said it was...
It was a hot game.
It was really hot. He had a lot of fun And there's a lot of Packer fans there. Like,
you could hear the Go Pack Go chant.
Even at the end, the announcers made the comment, like, all that's left in the stadium is green and gold.
He said they brought out a, he didn't say who it was, but they brought out a former Titan to kind of pump up the crowd, like, third quarter-ish. And, like, the guy came out, started doing his thing, and Go Pack Go started. And he, like, stopped.
Oh, my
He, like, stopped. And the guy, and he's like, yep, the guy stopped.
That's
and
savage
went back
out
up
there.
The tunnel, and he's like, screw it. I'm not even going to try. So, yeah. But think about it. Like, Nashville's a good city to go to. Like, it's kind of turning into a destination, right?
Especially for Midwest. I mean, it's not that far of a drive. It's kind of that limit of, you know, like from Wisconsin, it's 8 or 9 hour drive. Yeah, 10 or 11, you know, with stops and all that, probably 10 or 11.
It's probably closer to 10.
But it's doable. And then as far as flights, I mean, heck,
there's cheap flights.
From the ATW in Appleton to Nashville, it's pretty reasonable. So
you just got to pick their time, right?
Yes, true. Right, true.
But yeah, no, and it is a nice place most of the year. I mean, we were there in January for a conference a couple of years ago, and it was pretty nice.
It was decent. Yeah,
while we were there.
Yeah,
I think it was cold one night, but then during the day it got fairly warm.
It was nicer than San Antonio last year,
right? And we got there and it was like 35,
right?
But yeah, no, it's good. Good game, pretty solid game for the most part. I mean, there were a few hiccups. You could tell that Malik Willis is thankfully not the quarterback of the future. Some of his missed throws were a little bit weird, but he made it count and got the win. So now we'll see if Jordan Love's back for the Vikings.
I think he's back.
He'll be back. It's the Vikings, and they're undefeated. And that rivalry is just, now that they have Aaron Jones, Lions, I think we've always not minded, and the Packers have always hated, you know, it's always been Packer Bears.
Yep.
And but the Packer Vikings thing, because I feel like both these teams have been good in general in the last 10 to 15 years. So there's a real rivalry there. And
yeah. And with Favre going there and
right,
a lot of former Packers right, going to Minnesota, I think that's really fueled
Greg
it.
Jennings, Aaron Jones. Yep. It's almost like a.
The kicker, Ryan Longwell. Thank
Longwell,
you.
Yes.
Yep. The one player with the fastest kick to sideline ratio in the NFL.
Is that a fact?
They used to make fun of him when he was the kicker for the Vikings for that. Because, yeah, apparently he would never like try to block guy. Like he's not the guy on the kickoff that would try to tackle the last guy. He'd be like, nope, I'm off the field. but yeah, and you've got the Wisconsin-Minnesota rivalry with the Axe. So I think that kind of, it's a different, situation,
right.
But you know, just with the state of Minnesota, it's a more fun rivalry, I would say, than the Bears. Like the Bears, it's legitimate hate.
I see it the opposite. For me, it's more legitimate hate against the Vikings, and with Bear fans, I feel like it's because that was more in the 80s, and we sucked, and they were good, and
sure,
yeah,
and they really haven't been good since then.
But
I mean,
the Bears goes
deep. One
that's
year.
A long.
Oh yeah, that's long. I would agree with that. That's a good way to say it. The Bears runs deep, but it does seem like it's been better as of late.
I mean, at least we can make fun of Minnesota for the fact that they've never won a Super Bowl.
Well, and what's crazy about that is when Favre went there, they were literally like one Farvian throw
right.
from
he got them close yeah.
from getting there. So that's what's wild too is like he made them close, and that call is still one of the best calls where the Vikings. Yeah,
this isn't the Lions. This isn't Detroit. It's a Super Bowl.
All right, you guys ready to get to our topic?
Let's go.
All right, today we're talking about slugs. You might be wondering, well, why are we talking about slugs? We saw some this spring, actually quite
usually,
a bit.
Usually it's a spring thing, right?
Yeah.
No-till, early season, wet, worrying about the slugs. Not in September.
But yeah, the last week here I've seen slugs in fields to the south of us, not around here so much, but they are still active and had a couple farms that I deal with that are we're talking about how severe the issues they were having are.
And I've got some questions. So how are they the same slugs? Did you have slugs in these fields this spring and then they kind of went?
Yep. No, it's been like, been the same same fields.
And then what are they feeding on? Are they feeding on full-size corn plants? Are they
well, they were so bad
causing economic damage in some...
The soybeans
yeah.
were replanted, so there's still some green leaves out there
okay.
that they're feeding yeah, on.
Feeding on yeah. that. All right, all right.
In the replant area. So you've got these really kind of ugly-look-at fields because you've got dried-down beans that are probably close to harvest. You've got the replant beans where certain sections of the field were replanted, and they're still green. They're starting to drop leaves a little bit, but so the economic damage is done. I mean, the effectiveness of them being there now isn't as concerning as it was this spring, but it has led to a lot of questions, and we don't normally have that big of a deal with slugs. I mean, I go to the National No-Till Conference, and they've got whole sessions on talking about slugs because how bad they are in other places like the Eastern Corn Belt, Mid-Atlantic. Specifically, a lot of the information for today's podcast came from Ohio State, and Ohio's a state that deals with slugs quite a bit. Because a lot of the question I'm getting is, well, how long do they last, or how can we get rid of them? And being that we don't really have a need most times to do that, it led me to do some research, and I was kind of surprised at some of the things I found. So the life cycle of the slug is kind of interesting because, you know, when we think about, like, say, armyworm or other pests that can do a fair amount of economic damage, the bigger they are, the less concerned we get sometimes because they're closer to being done. Slugs are the opposite. When they're tiny, they can't do as much damage. And so if you can plant early and get the plants ahead of them, that's a benefit. But the bigger they get, the more damage they can do, the more they eat, and so they get worse as they mature. They're hermaphroditic, which means they don't need...
Please explain that.
They don't need a partner?
They still, from what I can find, they still like have a partner, but they don't... It's not asexual, which is where you don't need a partner.
Right.
Hermaphroditic means they have girl parts and boy parts, and so... When slugs get together, they swap boy stuff to fertilize eggs, and then they lay eggs. So they don't need to, like, it's not a male seeking out a female. They just need to find another slug.
Right.
So it's very simple. As long as there's another slug nearby, they will be able to procreate. They lay eggs, and they can lay
many. Thank you for the talk of that.
Yes. That's, yeah, you're welcome.
Thank you for the birds and the bees and the
agricultural
slugs.
Sex ed here on Tilt Talk Radio. And they lay eggs, so then they will crawl into cracks in the ground, lay their eggs, and they can lay, I think it was up to 500 eggs. Ooh. So if you and this is where I'm starting to get a little bit concerned, is, okay, if you have them, they're just going to keep procreating. They can live up to 2 years. So the slugs that were here this spring could still potentially be there next spring.
And next fall.
And next fall. So it's like, okay, this is getting kind of serious. They're most active in the spring and the fall, so they're fairly dormant during the summer most of the time. This year, though, I would say, and I don't know if you guys saw it, but especially in heavier soils, they were around fairly long
it
into the
summer.
Seemed
like because of the moisture, right. Consistent moisture in the soil, they yep. like that moist conditions, and they held into July a lot longer,
right.
And were affecting some of that later plant corn, and
yep.
yeah, they were a problem longer.
And this year they had more immature corn longer, too, right,
to feed on,
right? The, like you just said, Matt, getting planted early and up and growing, well, we didn't have that this year because we had a lot of
yep, and we had
different plantings.
Stunted growth for other reasons,
right?
Not just because of the slugs, but because of the wet conditions that, yeah, left them more vulnerable to this feeding. So chances are, you know, this year is an aberration, and, you know, next year hopefully won't be the same condition. But if we do get a wet spring, we could still see some activity here. So they really like the moist environment. So if you need it to dry out, the eggs can't survive in certain drier conditions. They need adequate soil moisture. So they like no-till. They like hay fields. They like fields that don't get worked where there's plenty of moisture. So, okay, now understand a little bit more about the slug and how it lives. So what can we do to get rid of it? Well, they're not insects. So insecticide's basically useless. I did find there was one insecticide, and I don't remember the name, that's labeled for slugs. But in research that was done on that insecticide, it had no effect on slugs.
It's not a slugicide.
It is not a slugicide because slugs are actually terrestrial gastropods, which is a type of mollusk. So they're like snails and that kind of thing where they don't react to insecticides. You need slug bait. So then I was looking into slug baits. I've heard, again, at the no-till conference, the guys that have slug issues, there's always, I think I get emails all the time from Ferox and their slug bait. It's like, okay, how effective is that? Well, there's two main types of slug bait that you see, and it's metaldehyde and iron phosphate. And metaldehyde is, I couldn't find if it's still legal in the U.S., but...
Well, right, is that a partner to formaldehyde, or...
That, I did not...
Yeah, it's just an interesting...
It's something where it can be poisonous to animals and stuff, so if it's not already illegal here, I wouldn't be surprised if down the road it becomes banned like it is in Europe because of the effect it can have on other wildlife. And then the iron phosphate, well, biggest thing with it is while they can be effective, you need the right concentrations. Metaldehyde, the Swiss company that makes it, it's got to be a 5% concentration. You can buy stuff that's 2 to 3% and then slugs will survive. It's hard to get a good application. It doesn't spread like fertilizer or lime where you can get good coverage, especially in wide swaths. So it can be difficult to apply. It's expensive. And then iron phosphate, which is the more common, is generally considered less effective than metaldehyde. So not great options when it comes to getting rid of them when using the slug bait. The other thing is salting them. So salt, some fertilizers and stuff have salt.
So basically we're trying to dehydrate
right.
their bodies,
yep.
right? Like basically...
We're trying to dry them down. Slug,
yes.
Yeah. That's the big thing is the moisture. They need that moisture content to live, to survive. This year we had adequate moisture. They had no problems. So hopefully we can get maybe this dry period that we're getting will hopefully... help thin the herd a little bit. One thing that was mentioned as a potential, and I heard it from other consultants, and it's one of those home remedies or wives' tales about just spraying urea on top of them. And there was some research on that, but it's the rule of three. Slugs are also nocturnal. Didn't mention that yet.
Okay.
So they're active at night. So that in that way, they're similar to armyworm and stuff where, you typically...
Cooler at night.
They're most active, right, in the cool part of the day. So they called it the rule of three. You got to spray it at 3 a.m.
Okay.
Fun.
And you have to do it three times.
So three times? Like
yep. So
3 days in a row?
Three nights. Go out.
Whoa.
3 nights in a row?
Right.
And that was the other rule.
Or most that's effective.
Just the 3 a.m.
It's 3 and 3.
I thought it was maybe like another third thing you got to do.
And the most effective rate was 10 gallons of urea with 10 gallons of water. So 20-gallon total rate.
10 gallons of urea. 10, no.
So
of 28%.
UAN, yeah.
Yes, got it. Would that might burn too. It probably
right.
will burn.
And that's something where, on a growing crop in the spring is going to be more problematic, whereas... this time of year
true,
might be better if they're still there and they're active, if you can harvest and then...
be cool if you could use streamer bars, but I don't know that would cover them as
right,
properly.
If you get the right coverage with
too much liquid that would run off any residue.
Right.
Because it's a contact thing, so it's got to make contact with the slug.
That's a tricky problem, too, is you need the water there to dilute it so it doesn't affect the crop. But like we just said, the slugs like the water, so
right.
It's also a...
It's a Sophie's choice of...
Yeah.
22.
Because I thought, too, about, well, can you put granular out there, and then but they'd have to come across the granule.
Sure.
You know, and I would assume... Like most things in nature, they'd have some sort of indicator like, ooh, I should avoid that.
I'm not going
not
by
go
that.
Lick. Yeah. It's not like a salt lick for a deer. You're not going to walk up and be like, what's this? Oh, killed me. And maybe a combination, you know, if you put some slug bait in with your fertilizer. I have no research to back that up, but maybe that would, you know, have an attractant where they would maybe come in contact with the fertilizer. If you could pair the two, might be effective. But really, tillage is the most effective, getting at the eggs and, you know,
burying residue,
destroying them so that the next crop doesn't come out. Plus, that dries out soil. And like I said, they need that certain soil moisture level to survive. They're fairly hardy creatures. They can survive, you know, lower moisture for a certain amount of time. And so it can't just be, you know, a short period of like just drying out the soil. Well, then it rains. Doesn't necessarily mean you've solved the problem. So even tillage may not be 100% effective. But the other problem is they like a lot of different things. They like cash crops like corn, soybean. They'll eat on alfalfa even. They like cover crops. They like rape, cereals. I've heard they dislike crimson clover. Don't know if that's... I couldn't find a lot to back that up. Also, somebody told me that certain brassicas that are higher in sulfur, they'll feed on them, but then the sulfur will help kill them.
It does seem like a lot of home remedies and anecdotal evidence.
Right, because it's not something we normally deal with.
Correct, and it does seem like they are hard. It's not something that chemistry can easily...
Right, I was just
going
to say, we don't have... A lot of mollusides.
No.
And you're not just going to spread salt out in your field because of
all
the obvious fact that salinity is not a great thing. Right. I mean, the old cheese factory way and all that kind of stuff might be effective too, but there's...
But you're going to hurt your crop.
Right.
Potentially, yes.
Yeah. So salt is bad for plants and slugs.
You're not going to go to Fleet and load a pallet of salt on and go spread it, right?
Right.
It'll work for your slugs, but you won't have a crop to harvest.
So, I mean, the bright side is it's not a widespread issue. And this year was an aberration with how wet we were. But we've been getting wetter years. You know, we didn't see it back in 1918, 1920. But now we're seeing it. So, you know, is it something we're going to deal with in the future? I don't know. But it's made me want to learn more about...
I think
this issue.
The other thing, too, Matt, potentially compared to those years, 5-6 years ago... More cover crops, more no-till, you know, more ability for those slugs to survive versus those years we were doing a lot of tillage because it was so wet.
Right.
Or trying to do a lot of tillage because we had ruts and other issues. So maybe this 5 years later with the push for cover crops, the push for no-till, we're just kind of maybe selecting, if you will, for that.
Yeah, and those conditions are ideal for them, but... They also can be ideal for their predator. So they do have a natural predator, and that's the ground beetle. And it's a very innocuous beetle. We've all seen them. I know we used to get them in our... you'd find them in the carpet every once in a while at home, like little black things. Like,
oh, yeah.
They're very prevalent and innocuous. They don't bother humans, really, or anything. But they like to eat slugs. So they also like environments. There's been anecdotal evidence that they like interseeding and that kind of stuff that makes a nice habitat for them, so they'll live in there and feed on the slugs. But the issue becomes that when we use seed treatments, especially on soybeans or corn with neonics in them, the neonics collect in the slug because the slug eats the plant, and they become poisonous to their own predators.
Oof.
Whoa.
So... It's like, okay, and then
oh,
you,
no.
So they can kind of withstand that. So it becomes a choice of, you know, when you're in that situation of no-till cover crop, do you reduce your use of seed treatments then to hopefully encourage beetles if you're having a major issue with this? Because like I said, the short-term solutions are tillage, maybe trying, you know, spraying some urea or the slug bait stuff out there and hopefully at least thinning out the herd. Rotation, not really going to do a whole lot. They like wheat. They like corn. They like beans. We've seen them in alfalfa. Yep. They're not as probably economically detrimental to alfalfa as they are the other cash crops. But yeah, there's not a lot of rotation options. So it will require, if you're having a serious issue, like some of these farms are having right now, and I'm hoping it doesn't continue into the future. But, you know, there's some decision-making here and trying to figure out ways to deal with this problem, and we're kind of early stages here in Wisconsin. The only upside, and I haven't found a lot of evidence about it, I know they're fairly hardy creatures, but if we actually get a winter this year, what effect that will have on slug populations? Because last year we didn't really have a winter per se. We had a couple cold weeks, but if they're underground, we know the ground really didn't freeze. Yeah. So maybe that's part of our problem, is we have a higher population this year because they sat dormant through the winter months, never got froze out, and that's why we had a explosion in population. And that may be the difference that we have compared to, you know, mid-Atlantic, even Ohio. I don't think they really get as cold as we do. So there's usually a reason we live where our face hurts in the wintertime. Because it helps with some of these issues. So
snakes, scorpions.
But yeah, I
don't have to deal with those either.
Well, we do have snakes.
Yeah, but not.
Not the timber rattler is the most, I think, deadly snake in the state, and they don't really, unless you're sticking your hand in dark rock crevices, I don't think you have to worry about them too much.
Nope.
So I just wanted to talk about it because, like I said, there are pockets in the state that are dealing with really severe slug pressure this year, and it was fairly wide early this year, like at least seeing some slug feeding, and that was in conventional tillage, it was in no-till cover crops. There was all sorts of scenarios where we're seeing it. So if this continues into the future where we have this issue, and I don't know that it will, but just something to kind of keep in mind, because with that longer lifespan, and if they don't freeze out, that means your slugs that were there this spring are still potentially going to be there next year. So we got to maybe kind of plan ahead. And so hopefully we'll have an opportunity to get in early. Maybe we'll get a dry period that'll help kind of thin the herd and maybe a real winter this winter. So, all right. With that, we'll wrap up with the slugs and move into our spotlight for today. A new GPS datum is coming and what that could mean for farmers. So farmers should be aware that in 2025 might be the last year they're able to use some AB lines and field boundaries recorded in the seasons past. According to the Ohio State University's Professor John Fulton, there's a new ag datum or set of reference point measurements coming to GPS systems by 2026. What's happening is they're basically redefining the datum, which is a mathematical model of the Earth that enables to calculate our position down here from satellites. And so they're making a change to that datum in 2026, means if you have predefined AB lines or if I have boundaries in my fields, the new datum gets executed, it will likely shift those about 3.5 feet. So if you're planting in on the ditch, on the corner or edge of the ditch now, you could be in the ditch next year or 2 years from now. But John Deere has said that their network does not utilize the datum that will be released, and so they should not see an impact with any Starfire receivers. As of yet, haven't seen anything from other equipment manufacturers, but John Deere didn't specify that their systems will not be included in this change. So it'd be a good conversation this winter to have with your equipment dealer, if it's not John Deere, to make sure that you don't have to do anything. There should be awareness that it's happening, and if you need to have a solution, be good to have that plan in place. But the upside is it will, the idea is behind this new datum is that it will actually improve accuracy of GPS.
It'll make things better.
Right. So some even of these it'll are, screw up your past stuff.
Well, some of these are very old, like NAD 83, which was North American datum of 1983, and the original is from 1927. So that's crazy to think, too, that in 1927, I mean, obviously they didn't have GPS then or satellites that helped, but they needed a way to map out, you know, the world and everything. But this, it seems odd that they'd be updating this, but if it does make it better, that's great. Yep. Yeah, if it could make it the language more specific and more accurate.
So, yeah, if you are affected, you may need to remap fields in the future, update equipment to make sure that everything's kind of jiving with the new data, and assess your connectivity. So evaluate current connectivity and signal strength on your farm, and keep in mind that robust connectivity is needed to help with, in particular, autonomous equipment if that's kind of the direction you're headed. So, yeah, I thought that was kind of interesting, and we'll see what happens with other ag manufacturers. Like I said, John Deere's come out and gotten ahead of it, but see what everybody else is doing. So now we'll move into our Ag History Minute. So as it is harvest season, thought bringing back up the topic of the silo would be good for Ag History Minute this week. So the silo pit, as it has been termed, has been a favorite way of storing grain from time immemorial in Asia. In Turkey and Persia, insurance agents would buy stores of wheat or barley, which were comparatively cheap, and store it in hidden pits against the seasons. In Malta, a relatively large stock of wheat was preserved in some hundreds of pits cut into rock. Single silo stored from 60 to 80 tons of wheat, which was, with proper precautions, kept in good condition for 4 years or more. First modern silo, a wooden and upright one filled with grain, was invented and built in 1873 in Spring Grove, Illinois, by Fred Hatch of McHenry County, Illinois. The first stone silos were built in the 1700s to 1800s BC. First above-ground silo in Clinton, Wisconsin, was built in 1877 by Byron Snyder. Not to be confused with grain bins, the word silos come from the Greek word Siros, meaning holding grain. In agriculture, silos are used to store fermented feed, also known as silage. Silos are commonly used in the industry to store bulk raw materials such as coal, cement, wood, chips, and sawdust. Today, there are generally three types of silos in use: tower silos, bunker silos, and bag silos. So there are still a few farms that use their silos, and
they're upright silos.
Yes, they are upright silos, not pits dug into the ground. That's where we store our manure, is in the pit. But, yeah, it's always a question I think a lot of people probably think more silos are in use than actually are, because a lot of times they don't get torn down right away, so old silos will sit even when they use feed pads and other stuff.
I was seeing one being filled last week that the roof was blown off by the tornado.
Okay.
And then they were filling it, and it was just cool to see it.
So you don't, I saw the same thing.
Yeah, you don't get to see the whole mechanism working up there and how well it worked.
Watching it blow out of the pipe at the top.
Well, it had the loader was all the way up, and it was kind of.
Okay.
It was odd how it was working. I don't remember, because you always had to have the unloader follow the corn silage up, correct?
Well,
Bill?
It just depends on the
system,
right?
Yeah.
So
yeah, not the old. So was it Big J or James Way?
One you do, because you had to make a tunnel in the middle.
Yeah.
As it went up, so it had to distribute around that tunnel being made.
Yeah, and that
this,
one,
this the, one, the end loader was all the way,
all the way to the top, to the yeah. top,
and obviously would be there anyway, but without the top of the silo put back
right,
on.
Right, you could see it.
Yeah,
yeah,
you could see it. Was obvious. Yeah, yeah.
I expected when it like. When it went around the spout, like it to be more of a, it was kind of almost like falling and
right,
like the pattern wasn't this big, like you see out of a chopper. I expected it to be more condensed pattern, but it was just kind of floating away.
Well, some guys would put like diverters on the end of the spout,
right,
that you could move, so then you could kind of aim it, especially right. when you were getting to the top of the silo to kind of help fill in.
Uncle Carl had one that you had to. Every other load, you had to flip the handle.
Flip the handle, yeah.
And that would move the...
Yeah.
His, you had to put doors in too, right?
Right.
Remember the old school one at Dad's where you had the really old doors? They were just, you know, the blocks of wood all the way up. And then you'd awesome. Have to take the unloader out.
That was awesome.
Physically take it out.
Yeah.
So when it was empty, it was easy because you just would walk. But when you filled it, then you had to crank everything up with the pulley.
Yep.
And
put it all together
and usually before you put it together you pitched it by hand for I don't know a 10, while
10 12 feet
yeah
I actually built silo doors.
You built it for the, like the wooden
one of my
silo
uncle's
doors
yeah. Yeah, is my dad was doing it and then I forget what happened to him, if he got hurt or whatever, and he couldn't finished the last one, so he kind of showed me how. And
yep.
I finished the last finished few for one of my uncles. Yeah,
yeah.
But yeah, those are. It was an old silo, and probably the newest thing in that silo for the in like 50 years. So
sure. Remember cranking the motor up, Bill?
Oh
that
my
thing
God.
Was a
it
beast.
Took like three guys.
Yeah, it was heavy, and it would just kind of, if it got moving around too much in the chute, you'd. Yeah,
the just hardest was, part too is when you got it up there
to get
it
in, yeah,
in the silo to get it
right, because certain guys needed to like hold it so it didn't go down, and then yeah, it was just.
But the work wasn't done then, because then the silo and loader would break while you were like trying to
use
it, and then you have to crawl up. And
that actually, I remember being, and as a kid, I never was up. Maybe you did that, Bill, but when Dad or Uncle Carl would be up in the. Silo, one would be up in the silo while it was running
sure.
to make sure it was working running. Properly, yeah. And you'd be like,
"Thinking
I,
back,
I think I pictured it going a lot faster than
right.
it would go." You know,
yeah, like, no, it's not like it's flying around right. like a fan,
like,
yeah.
right? But it goes, but yeah, I don't know the OSHA.
That was not OSHA approved yeah. at all.
So you guys didn't have the fun of laying on the silage, changing an auger out on a silo unloader.
I mean, we went up there, just not while it was running.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. Like,
no,
we were
we
up there.
Replace the auger while it was running.
No, I'm just saying we were up there.
That would
fixing
be very
it
dangerous.
And stuff, but just, and I don't think they did that often that I remember.
That's
it was
why
just,
we call Matt Stubby.
Yeah, yeah.
I just remember like a couple times doing that. Well, one time was to take a silo and loader out of a silo, but another time was. Fixing an auger and like you had this 5-gallon bucket that you pulled up with a rope with all the
tools
in it. And then naturally you'd forget, like somebody would forget a tool or something, and you have to send it back down. And
the one we had, the one Todd's talking about didn't have an auger, it had a chain.
Okay.
So. Sure. True. Yep. Good point. That's what you're right. And that chain would, yeah, that would.
But you'd always have to sit like. You'd have to stand right under the chute so you could hear him yell to turn it off.
Sure.
Which is the worst place to be. Yeah. We did not have a communication system besides the chute. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's the fun part, though, is you yelling down the chute and then it's like, what?
Yeah, right. I think they said stop.
And you gotta listen to the inflection of the voice because you may not hear the words. But if it sounds panicked, you probably should turn it off.
As soon as you heard words, you just turned it off. Yeah. Like, that was the just shut her down.
Did you mind climbing silo, Bill? Like, that side, like inside the chute.
I did not like outside.
No.
Yeah, if it had, like.
Well, I didn't mind outside on a harvester because it had
with
the
cage.
It had the cage and they were really close steps, usually, you know, or. So it wasn't so bad.
That was the one thing with that really old silo because it was a poured concrete. The rungs
were
decently far apart.
Right. Yeah. And I remember that as being like.
And very close to the, like.
To the wall.
There wasn't
right.
much
step kind of
step
there
if you will. Or
yep. Then, remember thinking,
and there's
like,
always
make
the
sure
wiggly
you
one
hold on
where you're climbing. You're like, eh.
Well, yeah, I wasn't worried about those. It was just they were really far apart, and you didn't have much to step on.
Yeah.
Like if you missed it, well, you were.
And it wasn't like they were clean and dry. They always had, you know, wet silage blown on them, and kind of it just. I remember it being both scary and exhilarating at the same time. You know, like being like, "Oh, this is cool." But also, like, holy, you know, like, just, and that silo, how tall is that silo?
40.
Yeah, it wasn't tall.
Yeah, no.
It wasn't like climbing an 80-footer.
Yeah. No, having the cage was always nice. Especially if you had to, like, do something, you could lean against
you could
the
lean
cage.
In it, yeah. Well, you wonder, like, well, the cage isn't really saving you from anything, but it is.
Right.
There is that sort of other. Well,
it'll make sure you fall to the bottom of the shaft. You're not going to fall away from the side.
Right.
You're just going to kind of rattle around a little bit until you get to the bottom.
But, yeah.
Bend your head a couple times.
It does, like you say, you can lean on it. It has, yeah, there's something to that. All right. Thanks for the silo talk.
Yeah.
Thank you to our listeners out there. Please subscribe to the podcast and tell a farmer friend. It's really easy. All you need to do is search Tilth Talk Radio in Apple Podcasts on your iPhone. Or on an Android phone, download an app like Podcast Addict. And there as well, you're going to search Tilth Talk Radio. You can also listen on your computer or smartphone browser. Go to tilthag.com/podcast. You can follow us on Facebook and X at Tilth Talk Radio.
All right. Thanks, Todd. Now we'll get into our Cool Beans That's Corny and some current events. So Cool Beans.
Cool Beans.
Cool Beans.
Cool Beans. Our Cool Beans this week. Above average harvest pace continues here in Wisconsin, so above normal temperatures and mostly dry conditions have allowed harvest to continue. According to USDA, 65% of soybeans are dropping their leaves, and soybean harvest is 9% complete. Corn for grain is 39% mature, and corn silage harvest is nearly halfway complete, which is ahead of average. And potato harvest is 62% complete. Winter wheat planting is underway at 34% complete. And 18% of that crop is emerged. Fourth cutting of alfalfa is also 79% complete. So we're just trucking along.
It don't feel that way, does it?
No,
I think
but
it's very variable by farm and their conditions
by region, how your spring went
of planting. But
and if the weather stays nice next week, beans are going to fly off the field.
Well, to the south, beans are
coming
off pretty steady from what I saw when I was down there the last couple of days. But
no, it's moving. It just, it's almost October. So I think it's
the late silage that
is
really
the biggest
one.
You're right.
And we all have farms that have that late silage. But when you drive around, there's a lot of bare silage fields. So I think it has been trucking along. All right, our That's Corny this week. A farmer in California is fighting a county $120,000 fine for housing his worker on site. So I think that's something that's fairly common here in Wisconsin, especially on larger farms. They'll have housing for workers and stuff near or on the farm. But this clash in California sounds like it's getting pretty expensive. So Michael Ballard is a farmer in California. He lets Marcelino Martinez, a 23-year career employee, live on site in a trailer in Santa Clara County. The officials have reacted with a blitz of code violations, yet the same officials permit thousands of homeless to reside in tents, shanties, and RVs across the county without penalty. So the bottom line for Ballard is if Martinez lives homeless on the streets and commutes to work on the farm, there's no problem. But being that he's residing in the farm on a trailer, even out of sight from public roads and neighboring properties, the action is illegal and deserves these high fines.
That's so California.
Doesn't it sound like a lot of fun? Don't you just want to go out there and do what we do? So he's fighting the county and... he says he'll never listen to power-crazy bureaucrats that tell me I have to kick a family off of our place. So in 1996, Michael and his wife Kelly bought Savannah Chanel Vineyards in East Central California outside of Saratoga, which was 60 acres of exquisite beauty overlooking redwoods and rolling hills. And with the labor and everything needed, they brought in Marcelino in 2013. He's been the vineyard manager and longtime employee, and he's lived there since 2013 in a 42-foot trailer with water, electricity, and septic hookups, along with his wife and three children. So, wasn't an issue until inspectors spotted the trailer on the vineyard property, and now it's become a bureaucratic nightmare. So, hopefully they'll be able to get that figured out. And I don't know, it just seems kind of a weird thing to have issue with. But glad it's there and not here. And finally, our Feel Good Friday this week. Michigan FFA has received $4 million from the state budget. So supporters of the Michigan FFA Association are celebrating one of the largest state investments in youth leadership, or in the youth leadership organization. Alex Schnabelrock with Michigan FFA Foundation says $4 million in current state educational budget will be transformational for the agricultural education. We're so excited because those funds will actually be going into an endowment that they will work for us in perpetuity. It's not, hey, how can we spend $4 million today? It's how can we save $4 million and use the interest to benefit FFA members forever. The funds will also immediately be used to reduce student member dues and leadership training costs, as well as fund a new staff position. So there you go.
I like that, because yeah. How many times do you see in government, like, oh, we had to spend this money or it was gone, right? Like,
yep.
We had to buy this whatever because if we didn't spend it, we'd lose it. Well, this is neat because they can put it in an endowment and it can create, live its life cycle, create more money and be able to.
Well, it's a good start for an endowment, too, because endowments, you have to use only the interest. And so if
you don't have much.
Yeah, if you've got 50 grand in there, it's like, woo. But 4 million, that's a pretty sizable chunk.
Yeah.
So, you know, if it's 5% interest on 4 million, that'll actually amount to something. So very cool. Well, that'll do it for this week. Thanks for being here, guys.
Thanks for having us, Matt.
So this week we talked about slugs, their life cycle, and how problematic they can be to get rid of. In our spotlight, we took a look at a new GPS datum, which is coming to satellite users near you. Ag History Minute, we talked about the history of the silo. Cool Beans this week was above average harvest pace is continuing in Wisconsin. That's corny. It's a California farmer is fighting $120,000 in fines for housing a worker on his farm. In our Field Good Friday, Michigan FFA received $4 million that will go into an endowment to continue to fund ag education there. So thanks for listening, and as always, happy farming.